believing that there's always a way. No matter how tough things look, there's always a way through.
If you want to get stuff done, then you have come to the right place. This is the Get Stuff Done podcast, brought to you in association with RDI Worldwide, a weekly interview series with prominent and diverse people from around the world who will share their own unique insights on what it takes to get stuff done and their personal strategies for doing so. My name is Gordon Dudley, the creator of the Get Stuff Done project and host of this podcast. Thank you so much for being with us. We hope you enjoy this episode and would love to hear your feedback anytime. Let's get stuff done. Hello and welcome back to the Get Stuff Done podcast. I'm your host, Gordon Dudley, and today I'm delighted to be joined by John Walker AM. John is originally from Australia. He, in fact, grew up in the US and has spent the last 40 years in Asia, divided between South Korea and Hong Kong. He is currently the founder and chairman of East Point Partners, but has had a long and illustrious career in quite a few different sectors. So we're going to be talking a lot about that. And so I think we can kind of jump right into it. I'm also happy to say that John is, I believe, the first person on the podcast with a title. AM at the end of his name there, member of the order for his work with the Sydney Olympics. John, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
It's a pleasure, Gordon. And that's, by the way, that's Order of Australia. The Order of Australia. When the Australians started to become a little preoccupied with the fact that they would rather be a republic, which they are still not, they decided to replace the British honours system with the Australian honours system, which was called the Order of Australia. So it was that moment in history when things were changing.
And so usually when you get some kind of award like that, as a Brit, you go to Buckingham Palace and a member of royalty will award that to you. How was that for you?
It was a similar sort of system. You know, so you go to Government House and the governor awards the pins the thing on your chest. So it's quite a formal ceremony, very similar, but there's no sword on the shoulder.
Okay, I see. And direct benefits from having this title? What is there anything that is kind of unexpectedly, which is a nice little perk of having it?
Well, it's not really. I mean, it's just the honour and the recognition. I was a little embarrassed at the time to get it because I had recently left my employment as a chief executive of a government agency, and these things are generally reserved for people when they retire. So I thought, well, I've already left government, and I was only in my 40s at the time. So it was quite a surprise and quite an honour, and obviously, from an Australian's point of view, this sort of recognition can have a benefit in business. Let's be frank, because it brings a lot of credibility.
Absolutely. Now, in the introduction, I just couldn't go through the full list of all the things that you have accomplished. So I want to kind of go into more details, but let's go back to the beginning. And I understand you spent the first 17 years of your life living and growing up in the US. How was that? I mean, those are your formative years. So tell me a little bit about the impact that had on your life.
Well, it was an interesting time. I was 18 months old and my brother was 3 weeks old, and my father was awarded a Fulbright scholarship to do his PhD at the University of Illinois. So okay. The routine for that 17 years was get back to Australia every couple of years for a year, then go back to the US. And we would always, that scholarship would be converted into the cheapest possible tickets and the cheapest possible accommodation, but my parents were quite keen that we travelled all the world on the way to and from the US. So it was a wonderful time of diversity, a wonderful, you know, a true education, I think, is around the diversity that you have in living among and working amongst different cultures. But I think I appreciated the opportunity to be working across a number of different education systems as well, so that it wasn't always the 3 R's, you know, reading, writing and arithmetic. It was the opportunity to study guitar and, you know, do a few different sort of things. So in retrospect, it was a little bit of a nuisance having to pack up and leave. And in the US, we lived in 3 different countries, in 3 different states. We were in Illinois for a while, then we were in Berkeley. My father ended up as a professor at Berkeley. Then we were up in Eugene, Oregon. I missed out on Hawaii, unfortunately. I had that age where I had to go back to Australia. But my brothers and sisters got the Hawaiian experience.
Oh, I see. Okay. But so as of 17, having spent basically your entire life in the US, were you speaking with an American accent? How American did you feel at that point versus Australian?
I still call tomato sauce ketchup, but I felt it was a little strange, but my accent got belted out of me on the rugby field. So eventually this, although people tell me my Australian accent is not necessarily so broad, and when I visit back to Australia, which I do every month now, I certainly, I still feel, you know, as the Koreans would say, bun bun, a little bit half and half.
Okay. All right. And so then from that early stage, you went to university, but I understand that you didn't complete your degree at that time.
No. Well, I sort of, you know, it was one of those things. My father is a very, very famous academic, you know, quite a famous professor across the US and Australia. He brought the discipline of educational administration to Australia. So people expected that I might, but frankly, university in one place was a little boring. I was more interested in playing in a band. I didn't have a great attendance record. And so I just, you know, I was having to do a lot of odd jobs to, at this point I was living away at home from home, and we won't go into the detail on that. But, you know, I was having to work at nights in a bakery, during the weekends loading bricks and tiles off trucks, and then a couple of nights a week playing music. And I just felt there was a different opportunity out there. So I moved to Sydney and joined the civil service.
And so, I mean, if we talk about civil service in almost every country, that's going to require a degree. So were you able to enter at that time without a degree? I know that later you did complete your degree. So I'm curious about how, I mean, it obviously has not affected you in the long run. It's, you know, that has not held you back in the slightest. Yeah. But how important was it for you to actually then complete it a little bit later on?
Yeah, it was quite important for me to complete it, but that was always my plan. At that point, to join the civil service, you did not require a degree.
Okay,
this is in the early 70s, around the same time, or before you were born, probably. And you know, the sort of job that you could get was not within the public service was not necessarily the most attractive. My first job was as an administrative assistant calculating the overtime payments for ministerial drivers. So, and which was quite challenging because I'm terrible at mathematics. It's never been one of my strong points. People wonder how I ended up a banker. But I went back fairly quickly and did my undergraduate degree. Then a bit later went back and did my honours. But at that time, I guess there was less focus on what a degree meant and more focus on what it is you could do to contribute in your role as a civil servant.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, that is, the name of this podcast, Get Stuff Done, right? The ability actually get stuff done rather than a piece of paper. And so that's why I was wondering if you had gone back and completed it, whether you feel that would have dramatically altered the course of your career?
It wouldn't have dramatically altered the course of my career at that time. It would have had some impact on my current multi-careers that I have. So
okay.
what you find is when you approach to join the board of an organisation, particularly in certain parts of the world, it's important that you have a degree and that you can demonstrate that you actually do have that degree, because there's been quite a few, I think, well-publicised cases of people embellishing the qualifications. So, for example, I sit on the board risk committee of a major Saudi company, and it was very important to them to be sure that I actually had that academic qualification before they could finalise the appointment.
So even though it was several decades ago, you actually had to produce the document.
That's right. That was right, which was something of a challenge, but it's the degrees are hanging in my wine cellar on my farm in Australia, so I frequent that sufficiently enough to recall where they were.
Sounds like a good place to be. And so then you had quite a long time working in the public sector in Australia. What were some of the the most enjoyable roles that you had whilst you were working in that area?
Yeah, I'd say that I described them as four of them. One was as the secretary to the cabinet. So I had, I was the only civil servant that could enter the cabinet room while the cabinet was meeting. And that was interesting. And there were some very interesting, things happening in Australia at that time. There was a major train accident where a number of people lost their lives. And I was in the room back and forth, sort of living and breathing how the top political echelons, react and behave in those circumstances. So that was one of them. I think the other was when I moved into a more policy role, was I led the process of the formulation and drafting of the first ever legislation banning nuclear power generation in Australia. And that's a memory that will stay with me. And this is in my 20s. So it was sort of an interesting time. The other is the Koreans would call Vice Minister for Transport, where I guess I was fortunate enough at the time that the world was moving towards privatisation. So I negotiated and signed the concession agreements for Australia's first private railway, which is the airport rail link in Sydney between the airport and the city, and then a number of toll roads. And the other was while I was in Canberra as the chief executive of the Chief Minister's Department, getting the job of corporatising some government entities, and most interestingly, reforming the industrial relations system. So it was my first experience walking through picket lines, my first experience someone trying to cut my throat with a broken bottle, my first experience in understanding the importance of patience and generosity in getting things done. Because in that case, I managed to get the Transport Workers Union, the bus drivers, to break ranks with the rest of the unions and get on board with changing the whole of government industrial relations agreements. So they're the four things that I guess stand out most for me.
And the public sector is quite different to the private sector. As you were moving through these roles, did you find yourself in leadership positions? Were you managing large numbers of people? You mentioned already about the necessity to influence others. I'm curious about that.
Mm. Yeah, well, in the case of Canberra, there was 7,000 people, and they included doctors and nurses and garbage collectors and policemen and that sort of thing. I guess in the transportation role, if you included, the rail system and the ports and the rest of it, thousands and thousands and thousands of people. But as a leader, it's very important that you focus a lot on the groups that are leading those groups, rather than seeing yourself as the sole person that does it all.
Right.
So, but I was kind of fortunate in that I was in the Energy Authority of New South Wales as well. I didn't mention that, but in that role, I introduced Australia's first ever energy efficiency labelling scheme, the stars you see on the refrigerator, etc. And that was kind of interesting, because you're dealing then your counterparties are also industry that feel threatened by something like that. In fact, I was fired from that job when the government changed. But I think the importance of just as a leader, seeing yourself as the person that makes other people's business plans reality is really the key. And that's really how you get things done. You get things done with an army, not with just the general, right? So I don't know whether you've heard of this military theory, Auftrag's Taktik and Befehl's Taktik. Mm-hmm. And under Befehl's
Taktik. I'm not familiar with that one.
Well, under Befehl's Taktik.
How does it go?
You're the general and you say to your troops, take that hill, you will take 5 tanks, you will fire 6 mortar shots and you will take it. Befehl's Taktik, Auftrag's Taktik, you say, take that hill and let me know what you need to take that hill. So I guess that's one of my learnings in government, where there's it's a little different to the private sector.
Yeah, and so how at home did you feel in the public sector? It does, it really runs at a different pace in a different type of. It has the KPIs are different. Let's put it like that.
I remember a headline in the Canberra Times, and I still have this on a wall somewhere in my study, which says, Walker says government should be run like a corporation.
Okay.
Now, and I meant that. As I look back, it was probably the most sort of politically astute, not the most politically astute thing to say at the time, but, with the civil service and government, you've got a responsibility to be accountable for sensible financial management as well as sensible economic and social management. I think one goes with the other. So I was a little bit of a fish out of water as I developed into these very senior roles, because I was very concerned that, communities should be sure that they're getting value for money, they're paying taxes. So in Canberra, for example, I converted the entire accounting system of the government from cash accounting to accrual accounting, which the opposition called cruel accounting. I had to keep explaining what accrual was at various estimates, committees, hearings, etc. I developed a very corporate view of how governments should run, and not everyone was comfortable with that. And, I did have quite a few interesting, debates and negative media articles, etc., in doing that. But I think that in the end, perhaps I left a little legacy. So, for example, in Canberra, all of the senior public servants were moved off their jobs for life and put on 3-year performance contracts, myself included, of course. And those performance contracts were not just monitored by the government of the day, but monitored by a parliamentary committee. So, as a senior civil servant, you had to appear before that committee and they had to be satisfied that you'd met your key performance indicators. And so as I say, that I think someone called me a bureaucratic terrorist at one point off the back of doing that. Disgruntled people that hadn't performed up to their key performance indicators. So I think you can do a bit of both, and as well as sort of working with the private sector in developing private infrastructure projects and privatizations and corporatizations, I think personally that helped prepare me for a life beyond government when I moved from government into the investment banking investment sector.
And when you were in the public sector, were you always thinking, I don't want to be in this forever. Thinking about that in the long term? Or
so, one of my rules in life is you never have a plan.
Okay.
You have an open mind, and this is how you get things done.
Good. Okay.
You have an open mind. Otherwise, if your mind is not open, you're not opportunistic. So I the good thing about being in government, public sector, is that you can achieve long lasting, sustainable things. You can touch and feel the outcome of what you do. It's not an academic exercise. It's not an esoteric exercise. you build that thing and you make that change and you can touch and feel it, which is why I like infrastructure, because it's the same yep. thing. But no, I didn't have a plan. I was about to sign another 3-year contract, and a headhunter came along. Oh, I should probably say executive recruiter, Hugh in particular, came along and asked whether I'd be interested in joining Bankers Trust as their head of government business, because I was, you know, government background plus the commercial work that I'd done. And simply, I just, because I keep this open mind and this opportunism, you know, I'm a strong believer in opportunity, I just, out of curiosity, I thought, yeah, why not? You know, I was 45 or 44 at that time and starting to think, you know, I was very happy with what I was doing, but, yeah, curiosity is a pretty powerful thing, right?
That's interesting. I mean, it does sound like the perfect transition from public sector to be given responsibility of government business in that private organization. But what would you say from the public sector work that you did was, you mentioned legacy. What would you maybe highlight as the largest impactful project you had or the greatest legacy that you left in that area?
Well, there's positives and negatives depending on your perspective. You can have negative legacies as well as positive ones. But okay. I do think the privatization stuff in the transportation sector was very important. So, you know, private toll roads, private railways, private maintenance facilities. I think that was important. I do think the idea of moving senior civil servants onto performance related outcomes was something that has a lasting impact and for the Australian Capital Territory government, obviously moving to a proper commercial accounting system had a big impact. And I guess the final thing I would say is that there are a lot of the people that worked with me, and one of the things that really turns me on is seeing how you can influence and support other people's career and growth and in other words, create sort of lasting change. A lot of the people that worked with me went on to great things, including some of the politicians that I work with. So I think the legacy around the people that on an ongoing basis continued to contribute is probably one of the more important things, actually.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that is, you know, that's a legacy that really endures through right. other people. So I think that's a significant one. So you're 45, you're taking a big step into an entirely new sector. Many people would personally find that too risky for themselves. They wouldn't do that. What was it? I mean, you said an open mind, but still, what was it that you kind of drove you to really make that leap?
Oh, just curiosity.
Okay.
So it's pure. I just wondered. I'd hired investment bankers. I had them working with me for me and paying their exorbitant fees and everything. But so I just wondered what it was like, really, on the other side. And you know, it was a bit of a shock at first. You know, so I had two secretaries, a driver, an office suite with a private bathroom and all that sort of stuff in government. When I joined Bankers Trust, I had a physically impaired executive assistant who was working for 8 people. Right, so she didn't have the ability to speak. I had a computer that I had no idea how to use. And I was just sitting in an open plan office. It was a little bit of a shock, but it brought me back. It brought me back to earth, pretty sharply. And that was, you know, that was very good for me. I mean, it's very good for you to come back to earth, and in a sense, sort of start again at the beginning. So the next challenge was, within a year of joining Bankers Trust, it went under. It went bankrupt.
Wow.
So as a result of the Russian currency crisis. And that was quite difficult for me because I had given up, you know, a three-year contract, which would have turned into another contract, et cetera, and yep. potentially some other yep. things in government. So that was a little uncomfortable, and I was just a little uncertain as to where I would end up. But, you know, I'm just one of the things I learned, actually, whilst I was completing my honours degree, one of the things I learned is that there's always a way. And again, it's this thing about having your mind open and being positive. And along came two senior people from Macquarie Group and said, John Walker AM, we'd love you to join us. And they actually acquired Bankers Trust Australian Investment Banking Operations, and as part of that acquired me as the new head of government business for the Asset and Infrastructure Group in Macquarie. So again, it's one of these things is there's always a way if your mind is open to it, and if you don't just right. sort of give up and go into the doldrums and just always think about, you know, always think about the next steps and be open to them. And that was, yeah, that move into Macquarie was transformative. That's the thing that brought me to Asia. That's the thing that brought me to Macquarie and has brought me so many other things since.
So 2000, you joined Macquarie. For those of you that don't know, Macquarie is the world's largest infrastructure asset manager, has currently over 20,000 people in 34 different countries around the world. And so at that point, you joined, where was Korea? I mean, Korea was not part of Macquarie's business. How did Korea come into the mix for yeah. you?
Well, as head of government business, I had the job of traveling around the world, helping the nascent Macquarie offices around the world understand the importance of relationships with government and regulators. So I was spending my life traveling to the US and the UK and particularly the UK and US and working with the teams there. But to be honest, I got a little bit sick of being the government guy.
Okay.
I did some very successful stuff. You know, we managed to convince the government to privatise something in Australia. But I just got sick of being the government guy. So I was at a half-year conference and went Nicholas Moore, who was the head of the Asset and Infrastructure Group and ultimately became the CEO of Macquarie, was talking about the importance of not being too dominant in any one market. Dominant sounds good, but it's dangerous because there's only one way to go, right? And it's downhill.
Right.
And Macquarie at that time was so dominant in Australia. So I just went up to him after he finished speaking and said, Nicholas, I want to go overseas and set up a business. And he said, oh, well, John, what about New York? You know, you grew up in America. I said, nah, look at me. Do you see Wall Street? I mean, Gordon, do you see Wall Street? No. So he said, what about Macquarie? What about Korea? The government is talking about privatizing and bringing private investment into infrastructure. It might be quite good timing for us to go there. So I, I was on a trip to New York, Toronto, Houston, and I came, the end of that trip came to Seoul and, you know, as soon as I landed, I could feel the energy, I could feel the zing, I could sense the opportunity and said, yeah, why not? So Nicholas gave me a one-way ticket and there we go.
Well, I mean, there we go. I mean, you did, achieve a lot, a well-established company, but still, you know, very much in a new market. And it was the first time that you said that you had been to Korea. So what were some of the initial challenges that you found doing business in Korea at that time?
Well, obviously language was not an easy thing. The fact that I knew absolutely nothing about the country was not an easy thing. So I think it was not too difficult because the Korean people have such a can-do attitude. And, you know, I think if you understand how to work with people and what motivates people, Korean people are probably the most ideal people to work with in the world because, I mean, I have this thing called failing to succeed. I think, you know, too often people jump in and will punish someone if they've made a mistake. And the way I think about that is you learn from failure and then you can go on to greater and greater things. So I think people like that. I think people like the idea of change, achieving a first, doing something for the first time that hasn't been done before. So it's sort of, and then, yeah, people like Korean people like people who practice what they preach, not just talk about it, but actually do it and get down there in the trenches with them, which, as you know, is, you know, particularly important to be in the trenches with the teams. So I think, but, you know, things to adjust to culturally. So, you know, one example that comes to mind is, you know, there was five of us to start with, but we were growing fairly quickly. We ended up growing to 400. But my executive assistant asked for a business card with a certain title on it. And, you know, as you would expect from someone from, you know, the US or Australia or the UK, I'll say, oh, yeah, whatever you want. Yeah, cool, of course. So she chose a particular title, which was, by the way, it was Daddy, which is not such a senior title. But this caused real disruption.
Yeah.
This caused real disruption amongst the team. So I had a delegation of the team and said, John, you've just let this person have a business card with that title. And, yeah, that's just not on. And I thought, well, I said, well, you know, come on, guys. Like, I'm not going to go back to her having agreed to do it, then say no. And someone I respect sort of, I was telling the story, said, John, you know, pull your finger out. You better start thinking about this and a way around it. I could have blown up the entire business, which was at a very early stage before we'd introduced the infrastructure funds. I could have blown up the entire business with that little bit of ignorance. I mean, the other thing that comes to mind is when we had a joint venture with the Shinhan Financial Group and the union officials started coming and talking to my team, you know, the Macquarie team, and trying to get the business unionised. And my response to that was not very smart. I sort of went into the CEO of Shinhan Group at the time and thumped the table and told him to stop those people coming in. And so I had to, despite my experiences with trade unions in Australia, this was a slightly different one. But again, I learned how to think about a more generous approach to resolving that issue. So yeah, culturally, I think and just being smart enough to stop and think, you know, how you should approach something and navigating it. Which is difficult in an environment when you have your headquarters saying, when does the profit coming? And, you know, you've got to balance all of those different factors. But it was worth it.
So it sounds like, on the one hand, you were bringing quite a refreshing and new style of management, and your personal style actually fitted well to not being overly hierarchical, like you mentioned. You're in the trenches, but at the same time, the cultural element was something that was obviously totally new to you, and you were you know, kind of applying away and in some cases finding that that's not necessarily the way it goes. So that, I guess, that kind of cultural adaptability came around. And so then, you know, you mentioned it went up to 400 people, you know, that phenomenal growth in a relatively short space of time. How then, I mean, obviously the role for managing five people is incredibly different to managing a much larger organization. How did you then go through that journey, that evolution of then managing such a large organization within Korea?
Yeah, well, I don't see the role of a leader as necessarily being a manager. I see, you know, the role of a leader is ensuring that there's managers in place and that they have what they need to be able to, as I said earlier, make their business plans reality. So I don't take any credit for the growth of the business. It was people that, one young guy came to me and said, I think we should have an infrastructure fund in Korea. I said, yeah, good idea. What do you need? And, you know, and that led to me importing some people that had background in funds and working with them. It led to me being available to go with that person and the team and visit the pension funds and and the others. It was the people that build the business were the managers that had the ideas about different business lines. And then, you know, I love this idea of success breeding success. So when other businesses within the Macquarie Group saw there was a successful infrastructure fund established in 2003, a fund listed in 2006, a good relationship with a group that had a good equity link warrant, other businesses started to come. So the early mythology within Macquarie is if your phone rings in Sydney and you don't know who it is, don't answer it because it might be John Walker, and if you touch it, you might end up in Korea. But that situation reversed itself to one where people were coming and seeing me and say, hey, I thought, ELW business might make sense here. And why don't we have a banking license? And so you let that success breed success and support the success of the managers. And I think that's the secret sauce to building a business. But personally, I made the point that I think, my role was as a leader, not a manager. Personally, I think it's that stuff about being down in the trenches and people, letting people feel your energy and your persistence and your commitment to the business. I don't know if you have you read Anti-Fragile? It's a very interesting book. Nassim Taleb is the same guy that wrote Black Swan.
Okay.
Yeah, I met him at a Mubadala business conference that I used to attend on a regular basis in Abu Dhabi, and he had this great question: what's the difference between a washing machine and a cat? Now, the answer to the question, I'm not going to embarrass you here, but the more you use a machine, the more it wears out. If you're a cat, if you stop moving, you perish. So, and he was using this reference in relation to financial markets and, what can you gain from disorder? I think in my experience in building and managing a business in a new market with a particular culture, can-do culture, is that you have to be that cat. You've got to be constantly moving, be available, put your body on the line, et cetera, et cetera. And then the managers of the businesses and the people that are building the businesses feel the confidence and that sense of commitment and walk over broken glass to build a successful business.
You mentioned a lot of your leadership approach is about equipping your team to go and do what they need to do and just making sure they have everything they need. How was it for you upwards in the organization? Often large organizations, they have a certain, risk policy. They have certain, things in place which maybe stop, excessively ambitious people from doing everything that they want to do. Were you fighting global headquarters to do what you wanted to do, or were you also given the same type of capability and free rein that you were affording to your team?
Well, I think it was fortunate. I mean, the culture of the organization, the culture of Macquarie Group, was one of bottom up, not top down. So there wasn't someone sitting in a room in Sydney, New York or London with a whiteboard deciding what your business would do. That was important. But at the same time, as businesses grow and become more complex and more global and more, halfway through my period there, before my spectacularly unsuccessful retirement in 2020 was, we were managing $25 billion of assets, so it became a very important, significant business. So obviously issues around compliance and scrutiny and, we had over 100 regulators around the world regulating us, became important. So my approach to that, I spent the first couple of years hardly leaving Korea at all, but my approach to that was to get the head office on quite a regular basis and meet with the head of compliance. My other approach was to put continued pressure on CEOs and group heads to visit Korea, which they did. I'm very thankful for the fact that they did that. And that support was just so important. You've made a really good point. It's really important, I think, when you're building a business in a new market, which is becoming bigger and more significant, that you don't just sit there and put yourself in a position where perhaps people in the head office don't have a proper understanding of the market and where the business is. But you can, SK Group were our, one of our, you know, they were our only platinum client. And this is, you know, very important in the global sense. And but you could imagine people in compliance in Sydney saying, well, but hasn't the chairman and the chairman's brother been in jail for a while? And you had to sort of explain the context and the market and the environment. So that idea of reaching out back, getting to head office was actually very important. And that was my role as a leader.
Mm.
That wasn't the role of people managing the individual businesses. And that's why it's important to think of yourself as partly air cover.
Right. But I can imagine that also having, you know, instigating those senior people from the organization to come to the Korean local organization probably also helped you locally as well, significantly, because they felt that this is not just, you know, our guy, John, you know, leading the charge. You know, we're part of a bigger thing, a wider thing. We have that senior backing as well. So I'm sure that had double positive impact. You mentioned 2020 retirement, but a failed retirement. Tell me what you mean by that.
Spectacularly. Well,
than ever before.
I turned 65 in 2020. So I thought, well, you know,
okay,
it's probably, yeah, probably a reasonable. I was sort of feeling a little guilty because so many of my counterparties were retiring at 55, but
okay,
that coincided. Often I blame myself for COVID because that March 2020 coincided with when COVID really took off, and I was sitting on a number of boards of different sort of global groups at that point anyway in the ESG space, so they were not things that clashed with my role with Macquarie. So they continued, but with the inability of people to travel into Asia, many companies who are either planning to come to Asia or had come recently did not want to lose their momentum despite the fact they couldn't travel. So basically East Point became this vehicle through which a group of European, US and Australian companies could utilise my networks. Now, we hadn't mentioned that for the last 10 years in Macquarie, as well as chairman of Korea, I was chairman of Asia for Macquarie Capital. So I had also built up, you know, done a lot of the same things I did in Korea across other markets in Asia, Japan, China, Philippines, Indonesia, etc. So I became extremely busy helping these groups continue their momentum, their education on the markets, their relationships in the markets, and of necessity then had to find partners in those markets that would work as part of East Point. And it got out of control.
In the best possible way, it got out
in
of
the
control,
best possible
I think.
Way, the best possible yeah. way. And I mentioned, you know, the washing machine and the cat. Well, I'm definitely the cat. And so East Point and my partners are kept very busy. One of our signature things a couple of years ago was advising the Indonesian government on helping them set up their first ever sovereign wealth fund, you know, et cetera. So now, in addition to East Point, the other reason for my spectacular lack of success in retiring is I also sit on multiple boards of, interestingly, not Macquarie, but other very, very large financial institutions. So I chair BlackRock's renewable energy company here in Korea. I'm on the board of their large energy storage company. I'm on the board of their infrastructure solutions business. So I work with a number of other very large financial institutions as well. But I frankly, I don't think I ever had in my mind retirement.
Not really. At least still working in the space that you've been in. So that brings me
to... With flexibility.
Flexibility and choice is the ideal. In that sense, you've achieved what most people hope to do, and not everybody succeeds in doing that. So that brings me to the key question I ask to all my my guests on the podcast, which is, how is it that you get everything done that you need to get done on a daily, weekly, monthly, annual basis?
I think, well, for me, I think a sense of adventure is something to really think about, because if you have a sense of adventure, you're more likely to try something new and perhaps just stretch yourself a little more than you would. I think the other one is to have a generous character and generous spirit, and by that I don't mean giving some of what you earn to charities and stuff, which you know I do, but it's being generous with the people around you, supporting them in their business, being understanding and supporting them in their life and this sort of thing, because what you give, you get back in that sense. I think the other thing is this idea of this believing that there's always a way. No matter how tough things look, there's always a way through. So that positive mindset is just, I think, really, really important. So it's the idea of a sense of adventure, generosity, believing there's a way through. For me, the idea of achieving a first, doing something that hasn't been done before, is very, very, is really sort of very, very stimulating. And that stimulation is important, right? And then, of course, there's persistence. And then there's being the cat. I mean, you just, energy breeds energy. And
energy breed energy. I agree. Definitely infectious. Even as something as simple as a smile, I think it can can start from that with the positive energy. And mornings are also, I think, an interesting one, right? You know, a lot of people struggle to wake up in the morning, to get going in the morning. But you know, if there's somebody there who's up and at it, ready to go, you can see how that just automatically lifts people. Believing there's always a way, but there must have been a time when you came incredibly close to doubting and, you know, believing that there is a way. Is there a particular time that comes to mind where you thought there might not be a way at this time?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's two examples that come to mind. One was, I mentioned earlier, I introduced this, I was in charge of introducing this energy labeling, energy efficiency scheme, and when the government changed, the white goods industry complained about me and complained about, you know, my impact of doing things for the good of the community was affecting their profit. So I was fired by the minister, the energy minister, summarily fired. 3 weeks later, I was working for the premier, who the US people in the US call the governor, in his management review group, doing over other government departments. And I got the chance to do over the energy department, but that's and got the minister fired. But that's by the by. I think that, and it comes back to my point about generosity and movement. The person who had become the head of the Premier's department, the vice minister of the Premier's department, was someone who had been in another public sector job, and some years before then I had supported in a particular issue. And when he heard that I had been dismissed because of something that a previous government had asked me to do, snapped me up straight away. So I'd supported him, been generous to him in the past, and what goes around comes around. So that's one. But I was pretty depressed when I was just summarily fired, having done what I was asked to do. Then the other one that comes to mind is not very business related, but it's something that really sticks with me through every stage of my life. And I had completed my honours thesis, which was a thesis on democratic theory. Well, pretty boring, but it benefited from the fact that I'd been at the coalface in government, dealing with lobby groups and communities and sort of getting a chance to see democracy at play. And I had my thesis all bound and all ready to go, and it was due that afternoon to be submitted to the professor. And I was just flicking through it, and my God, there was a page missing. So here I was, hours away from submitting my thesis. If I didn't submit my thesis on time, goodbye my honours. So, oh dear. So I actually didn't know what to do, but the only thing I knew to do was not give up. So the old Winston Churchill thing, right? Never, ever, 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 ever give up. So I rang my father and said, "Dad, this is what happened. What do you think I should do? I think my options are to ring the professor and say, I've just discovered this stuff up, or to find another way." And he had submitted his master's thesis at the University of Sydney. I was living in Sydney at the time, many, many, many years beforehand. And he said, "Look, there was this place I used to go to get my documents bound, just around the corner from the university. Let me look." And he told me how to find it. And lo and behold, there's this old guy in there with all the equipment still binding students' theses. And he was a septuagenarian. I mean, I'm nearly a septuagenarian now, so I'm sort of hesitant to use the word. But he, I brought a copy, I brought the page, and he spliced it in for me. So it was just totally unrecognizable that a page had been missing. He spliced it in for me. It took him 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Problem solved. Submitted my thesis and got the degree. So it was always a way. It just seemed like an impossible, you know, the bound thesis, you know, like beautiful, yep, black, heavy cover. And so it's just,
yep, yep.
It's not a business example, but, you know, I often reflect on the fact that what I thought was an impossible situation was not impossible. Why? Because I believe there was always a way. And secondly, because of my father. And I was sensible enough to reach out to someone and not dwell on the problem myself. So I think that's right. A big learning. Always reach out to somebody.
Because probably when you called your father, you probably didn't have too much hope that he could do much, I guess.
I was just expecting he would say, "Well, you know, yeah, you better ring the professor," or, you know,
right,
something like that.
Right.
But he had exactly a solution for me.
Right, exactly.
And you don't know exactly if you don't ask, right?
Exactly.
You don't know if you don't ask.
100%. Yeah. 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 It's that.
So not a very business-oriented example, but it's something that stuck with me for business. Nothing is impossible. There's always a way.
Absolutely. And so how do you spend your time when you're not working?
I swim, go to the gym.
Okay.
I'm a writer. I'm in the process of writing my third children's book at the moment. And the first two have all sold out. I've got to do something about that when I'm traveling less and get them reprinted. And then I write music. I've had three albums. As you know, I have three albums that have been released. And I'm in the process of, these days I'm tending to write individual songs for particular charities. So the last one was one called Ninja Nannies, where I helped a group of teachers, grandmas, Taekwondo in Australia, raised the money to build a hall. And I'm writing one now called Pink Angels for an adoption charity in Cambodia that prevents young women going down the path of prostitution. So that's, but with my spectacularly unsuccessful retirement these days, I'm finding less and less time to write music and write, and I'll have to think of what I can do. I've got a travel guitar now. I sit on the aircraft and write a little bit with this little guitar, which amuses some of the other passengers from time to time.
So is the music something that helps to balance your work, or is it something that actually inspires your work? How do you, or is it something, is it just a switch off type of kind of refresh thing for you?
For everything for me, there's a coincidence with work. So When I was releasing these albums in Macquarie days, you know, we toured across Japan and the Philippines and the US and other places, and it coincided with Macquarie being able to invite its clients to these events, and sort of the organisation is seen in a slightly different light. But with all of my music, it did. With all of my music, though, but there was always a charitable outcome. So in Japan, for example, that particular album, Rain Draining, supported a a charity that helps kids find a place to study. Kids with both parents are working, find a place to study and do their homework. So all of these have a charitable angle to them. The money, when people download on iTunes or Spotify, doesn't come into John Walker's account. It comes into an account that then goes on to these. But and in that sense, you know, this generosity idea is something the clients also found appealing. And, of course, I invite my clients because they tend to have the means to be able to donate and be generous in themselves to the various things that the music is supporting. So inevitably there's always a coincidence between what I do personally and do to relax and business, because I talk about it with my business relationships and they find it interesting. And
yeah,
and then there we go.
As you're explaining that, I'm thinking that the full circle comes from the authenticity of your generosity in doing the music, which is then helping others, of course, is recognized as being sincere. And so that then is, motivating them to do similar types of things, whether that's, you know, directly client or otherwise. And so then it amplifies and keeps going. So I think that's really, you know, why, you know, those things have become even, you know, so much greater. And I think the fact that, you know, we've talked for so long and we've only just touched on that, and yet it's a whole other, string to your bow, another element of your life, which I'm sure we could talk about in more detail as well.
But, the key, Gordon, is not to plan. Don't sit down and say, I'm going to be an amateur musician. Don't. It's just have your mind open, and there's some opportunity presents itself. It's the whole point about my career and what I do now. The opportunity presents itself if your mind is open and you haven't over-planned. This is advice I give to younger people. You know, prepare yourself for a range of opportunities, not just for one, and be open. I recall clients travelling around watching and listening to my music on Cathay Pacific and on Singapore Airlines, etc. I managed to convince them to be generous as well and to carry my music on their in-flight entertainment systems, and how that presented in itself opportunities across a range of things. So for me, it's really about that opportunistic, energetic mindset, and then overlaying that with generosity and this view around sort of tolerating failure, et cetera. Thanks for this, because you've helped me reflect on lots of things that'll be beneficial for me going forward.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. And I think everything that you've just mentioned there, you know, that is how you can achieve great things. It's also how you can get stuff done. And I think it's also how you can lead an interesting and adventurous non-linear type of life, which you know, you absolutely have. And I don't think it seems like you're going to stop anytime soon either, which is great. And you seem to also still be traveling a huge amount.
Yep. I have some fantastic meetings in Madrid next week. I'm flying out a couple of nights and meeting with some renewable energy players and others there, which I'm looking forward to.
Well, John, thanks so much for being my guest today and sharing your insights and experiences through your career. Really appreciate
Pleasure. It's been great for me too. Thank you very much, Gordon. Thanks.
And to everybody who's been listening and watching, thanks so much. And remember, let's get stuff done.
Thank you for listening to the Get Stuff Done podcast. If you would like to be a guest in the future, please do reach out. Or if you would like to recommend someone, that would be awesome as well. Make sure you keep listening, as we will be bringing you fresh insights every week, because getting stuff done is something everyone needs.